Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, this veteran enjoys a peaceful view of the ocean from his backyard in Morro Bay, but at Omaha Beach in June of 44, his eyes witnessed something very different.
The bodies were being brought in on trucks stacked like cordwood.
He came pretty close to being one of those bodies, and this World War II tank commander will tell us all about it today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each week we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want our World War II veterans to know that we appreciate their service and their sacrifice. We want to honor them for that. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. Along the way, we learned quite a bit about what our country was like way back when and how big a price has been paid for the freedom that we enjoy every day. The name of the show sometimes ruffles a few feathers with our veterans because they don't like to be called heroes, but I call it Hometown Heroes because of the idea that no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, whether it's a big town or a little town, maybe it's Morro Bay, California, you never know who's living down the street. There might be someone right next door to you who's done incredible things for the sake of freedom. And that's the case today. We are in Morro Bay on the Central Coast visiting with Charles Jennings. He's going to be 90 years old in February. What are you going to do for number 90? You got any big plans?
Dancing and carousing and all those things that some people do. But I forgot about all that years ago. And so I'll probably be sitting right here looking at the television and wishing I was able to do more than I'm doing now.
Just sit here and look out at the fantastic view from your deck. Pacific Ocean past the Morro Strand. I don't think that's what it looked like in Europe in the winter of 1944, and we're going to get to that. But you grew up in the Northeast. What was it like growing up in Vermont?
Well, I suppose just like anybody else, except that we were freezing more than anybody else was. We got down to 42 below zero one time there that I remember, and that's pretty chilly. But my dad was killed in a truck wreck when I was only 5 years old, so I don't have any memory of him. But I went to live with my grandparents then in Boston. So that's where I got my early start that I appreciated now more than then, because my grandparents were, well, rather strict Bostonians, and so I got all the little niceties explained about manners and language and so forth. Since then, it had been greatly appreciated, you know, because not everybody gets that kind of background. But when I was 12, then I left my grandparents and went back to live with my mother in Vermont, and was there until I graduated high school, doing absolutely nothing noteworthy other than playing in the school band, which was quite an experience because we got to play at the New York World's Fair in 1939, which was a great experience.
What'd you play?
Drums. I don't know whether you can really call that playing or not. It was just banging things out, you know. But it was a great experience, and I was there until I graduated high school in 1942. From there on, the story changes quite a bit, because so did I. I was 18 and looking forward to getting into the Army and doing whatever they did in the Army I didn't know much about at that time.
Well, yeah, you said the story changes. The world changed a little bit your senior year in high school. And I imagine it was pretty cold in Vermont in December of 1941. Do you remember how you found out that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Well, yes. Just listening to the radio on a Sunday morning, and the news came on, and it didn't seem real, really, that it was actually happening. I don't think any of us, at least in my family, realized just how important and how different things were going to be from that time on. We really had no thought of being in the war, which was then confined just to Europe and Asia, you know. But it was exciting news to hear, but we, of course, didn't have any idea how it was going to affect all of us. We were just kids, actually, in high school, and it was not part of the general world that was experiencing such horrible things at that time.
Did you get drafted, or did you go in on your own?
They weren't drafting 18-year-olds until January of 1943. So, like so many others, I quit my job and enlisted. I was actually in a draft-proof job at the time, because working for the American Locomotive Company, and at that time they were making tanks. The particular job that I had was in the materials department, where we were determining the value of all the various parts of the tank and what they did. But that was a little more than I could stand to be working with tanks, and then hearing the radio about all the things that were going on that involved tanks sometimes. And so I just quit my job, and in November of that year, I got into the Army. So when I went to the tanks, they said, "Where do you want to go?" So I said, "That's it, you know, tanks."
You're saying because your job was vital to the defense industry, you could have had an exemption from service and never gone overseas, but here you're working on these tanks, and you said, "I don't want to just work on them, I want to operate them," huh?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, the foreman that I was working under asked me to come to lunch with him one day, and he informed me that he had just got the permission to put me in this draft-proof job. And I informed him that I had just got permission from somewhere to join the Army. So he was a little disappointed. After all his work, it took him months, I guess, to get that kind of an exemption. But it was something I just had to do. Everybody was getting involved. So,
well, that was my next question. What was that motivation? Why was it so important for you to do that?
I suppose a couple of reasons that are not related at all, but one was that I wanted to do something that could be part of all that was happening at that time. The other reason was anytime I walked down the street or was out anywhere, people were wondering, why is this young fella here still wandering around in civilian clothes when he's supposed to be going into the Army? So I didn't want any more of that. So I said, I'm going to do the right thing.
And so you wanted to get involved in tanks, and that's exactly what happened?
Oh, yes. They said I had to make three choices. In case I couldn't get in one branch, I could get in another. But when one of my choices was tanks, why, they didn't have to look at the other two choices, because that's where they needed people. And that was fine with me. That's where I wanted to be anyway.
How long did your training take? And were there some challenges along the way?
Not long. I went in November and had 90 days of basic training. And then when basic training was over, they kept 12 of us from the 250 that was in our training group. They kept 12 of us afterward to take part in training the next group that came out, the next 250. So that's what I did for a couple of months. But then that wasn't quite enough for me. I wanted to do something more than that. And the captain of the training company said, "You're going to OCS." And I, of course, knew absolutely nothing. So I said, "What's OCS?" He said, "Well, that's Officer Candidate School. You're going to go in and train to be an officer." I said, "Really? All I wanted to be was a corporal and not get too much involved." But that was okay, because I didn't know that I would ever make it through OCS anyway. But as it turned out, in July of the following year, I was commissioned the second lieutenant, which was kind of ridiculous because I had only been in since November. And here it is. I was just a kid, not even dry behind the ears yet, and I was lieutenant. From there, it was a matter of being moved from one place to another, eventually getting to a unit instead of just a training group, you know. But that was the beginning.
And I get the sense, if working in the factory wasn't good enough for you and you had to go in the service, and then, you know, just instructing guys wasn't good enough for you and you wanted some action, that once you got assigned to a unit, you were probably in a real hurry to get overseas. I imagine you were itching to go do something.
Well, yes. We went from Fort Knox, Kentucky, down to Louisiana, and then out to Desert Maneuvers. It was from there that I was able to volunteer along with 60 others to go overseas right away instead of waiting to get called to go. We had to go a little early.
So when was that? When did you head overseas?
January of 44. Went to England first. We went through a lot more training, but this time it was more tactical type of training, of learning how to make use of tanks and doing whatever was necessary in England to learn what it was we were about to do. We didn't know when, of course, but on the third day after D-Day, we landed in Normandy. Things were not very simple for any of us at the time because we were still getting off the beach in Normandy, finding getting up over the cliffs, and I'm sure that there's a lot of people that could tell you stories about what it was like on the beach out there in Normandy on the third day, but it took a lot of guys out of it entirely right away. In fact, as we were going in, we had been issued what we call burp guns. You may have heard of that expression before, but they were almost like toy machine guns, but because they were made of stamped metal rather than cast. They were like a grease gun, really. That's what we called them. So when we made the beach in Normandy, there were lots of regular Thompson submachine guns available to us from the guys that had been killed and didn't need them anymore. So we picked them up and used them from that point on.
So everyone understands how this is working. Are you taking the tanks ashore here? How did that work? Were you coming off an LST or something on board a tank?
Well, it came off an LST, all right, but it was just men and not equipment. They were coming in separately. The tanks were being brought in, and as a matter of fact, a lot of them were getting sunk because I don't think anybody realized just how difficult it was to keep a 30 or 15-ton tank from sinking.
Do you know which beach it was at Normandy?
It was Omaha. We had the British on one side of us. Omaha Beach was the main force that was going in. It was exciting and frightening, very much so. I don't know of anybody who couldn't admit to being pretty scared of what was happening at the time.
Was there an emotional impact on you walking ashore on that beach, which had been the bloodiest 2 days earlier and I'm sure is still just catastrophic everywhere you look? What was that like as a young man? I mean, you're what, 21 years old, to look around and see all of that?
Yeah, I wasn't 21. I was 20. About all I could say now is that I was probably pretty scared along with everybody else. And we were replacements. Even on the third day, we were just replacements. But after we got up the cliffs there at Normandy, it was a couple of weeks before we got tanks. And so during that couple of weeks, we had plenty of time to get scared and plenty of time to see things that we'd never seen before, like guys getting mowed down around you, infantrymen. The Germans were bombing pretty heavily then and strafing with their light planes. And so we were getting peppered on the beach, and our tents, our half tents, I'm sure you've heard that expression before, shelter half, they were getting punctured full of holes because the planes were shooting down on the beach. But that wasn't all of it, because our planes were chasing them, so that meant they were both firing down onto the beach, and all of our tents and clothes, everything got shot up pretty bad.
How close did you come to getting shot up yourself?
I don't know exactly. A lot of guys were getting hit around us, but I was not hit at all. Just my shelter half and anything I had there, all these nice canvas bags and things that they gave us to put things in, we're getting shot full of holes.
Welcome to the war, huh?
Oh, boy. I'll say that was quite an experience. And one thing that was quite impressive to me, and I'm sure to everybody else, was right in the next field to where we were was a graves registration group. And the bodies were being brought in on trucks, stacked like cordwood in the back of the trucks, and then laid out in rows, and tags, like shipping tags, were being fastened to their shirts that had the real ironic comment written on them, eligible for Purple Heart. And then, of course, there were German bodies also, because the planes, some of them were getting shot down. It was a very hot and wet time because it was raining all the time. It just seems as though it just never stopped raining. We were seeing things, of course, they'd never expected to see. And a lot of the French farmers there were seeing things they didn't have never expected to see either, because their cows were getting killed. One farmer came into this area where we were just waiting to be assigned somewhere, said to come and join him because his cows were getting killed, and he wanted to put on a feast for the American officers. It seemed like a kind of a strange invitation at the time with all the hot stuff flying around us, but several of us took advantage of that and went to this little farmhouse, and he had all these steaks there from his own cattle. He said he just wanted to do what he could and not waste what had happened to his cattle. Of course, he was explaining all that in French, so we had to have a little interpretation along the way about what is he talking about. It was fascinating, too, that he had a huge fireplace, and there were two, I think they call them andirons, on hinges, one on each side of the fireplace, with a big pot on one of them, and a big flat thing like a pie tin on the other side, but a huge thing. And he could swing those things in over the fire. He had all these steaks cooking on it. And in the pots, he was making what we found out was French fries, which we had not had any name for before. But of course they were French fries, natural. Anyway, that's the way it was that first couple of weeks on the beach.
I'm guessing that's probably the most surreal steak dinner you've had in your life, huh? You've just witnessed this incredible carnage that the world's never seen, and now you're in a farmhouse eating steak.
Yes, all of it was real because I hadn't had steak dinners before. We didn't have much steak when I was growing up, if I remember any steak at all. But it would have been good no matter what.
Yeah, for sure. A moment of comfort and calm in the midst of chaos. But there were much less mundane moments in store for Charles Jennings as he served in the 2nd Armored Division in World War II. When we come back, we'll hear about the time an incoming artillery shell killed two of his crew and blew him right out of his tank. Months later, he would be wounded even more severely by a blast that left him with extensive damage to his chest. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lafler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this time with 89-year-old Charles Jennings of Morro Bay, California. He was a tank commander in the 2nd Armored Division during World War II. A real survivor, I think you'll agree, by the end of this program. Speaking of survivors, I got to spend some good time with a couple of former prisoners of war who have been on this program. The Tulare Downtown Association this past week had a Tulare's Hometown Heroes Night at their street fair and farmer's market. They're trying to raise money to send 5 Tulare veterans to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Leonard Cosby and Judge M.W. Del Rey are 2 ex-POWs in line for that trip next month, and so is Harry Mercer, who you're going to hear from on Hometown Heroes in a couple weeks. Thanks to all 3 of those veterans for helping to put a face on our mission there in Tulare, and thanks to John and Renee and all of you there who made that night possible. Thanks for your support of Honor Flight. Okay, back to Mr. Jennings now. One thing I'm curious about, when you are confronted with all that death and destruction everywhere, and you see these bodies stacked like they are, and these are guys the same age as you or younger, how do you maintain your composure? How do you keep going believing that there's actually a future for you?
I don't know that any thought was given to that. Every day and every hour was taken up with something that was happening around us, and I don't know that anybody was giving a lot of philosophical thought about the purpose of all this or what the real meaning was or anything. It was just excitement.
And I'm sure it was exciting to actually get your tank, because all these tanks were sunk, and I guess the tank you were supposed to get was sunk in the landing, so you had to wait. Once you finally got a tank, how did that work, and what were you responsible for on that tank?
It was a miscellaneous unit, really. It wasn't a real division at the time because everything was so mixed up. We weren't in a unit that we called our own unit, whatever was needed at the time. But it was a relief in a way to finally get into the tanks, because we could see around us all these poor infantrymen who didn't have anything wrapped around them like we had. Whatever shells were hitting the tank, they were not shells, they were bullets, really, because they were flying. But it just sounded like rain on the tank. I don't know what it must have been like for those poor guys that didn't have a tank to wrap up in.
What was your perspective from inside that tank? How much could you actually see in a situation like that where bullets are flying, artillery's flying? What's your perspective from in there?
Well, of course, we were seeing what was happening around us through a periscope in a way. It was only 8 inches wide and 2 inches high. We were looking out at all this that was going on around us. And, of course, we were able to swing the turret around anyway so we could see everything. But we got our orders from radio. The radio was very difficult to hear sometimes because they were instructing us from other tanks. And it was kind of a strange. But at that time, we actually were able to sort of forget how dangerous it was because we felt so secure inside the tank. But when the tank I was in finally got hit, I have no idea, of course, what hit us, but it was a big shell, and the tank tilted, and the tracks got blown off. And unfortunately, the driver and the assistant driver were killed right away, and the gunner had his leg blown off. And I was almost lifted out of the tank through the top, so that I just got a minor wound in my leg. Just a fragment hit my leg, but it lifted me sort of right out of the tank. But I was able to climb back on the tank while it was going to be burning badly, but I got the gunner out. He was already halfway out anyway, and I got him out on the ground and just called for a medic. Had no idea whether there's any medics around or not, but somebody came and took care of him. And I don't know what happened to him afterward, but that's as far as we got there. And that was only 2 weeks after we got there.
Where was that? Where did that happen?
St. Lo. You may have heard of St. Lo before.
Your tanks were part of the big breakout there, right?
Well, we weren't actually part of the attack on St. Lo. I was part of this casual unit that was going around to the north of St. Lo. But we could hear about all that was going on because, as you may have discovered by now, that the town of St. Lo was just flattened as much from our own artillery firing as from the German firing. The town was just totally destroyed. It was just awful. We heard that there was a journalist there. He was experienced that what was happening, because unfortunately our own planes came over, what looked like hundreds of them came over and started dropping their bombs on the German forces. They call it sometimes the German lines, but they weren't lines. They were just wherever they happened to be. But unfortunately, the wind was blowing pretty heavy, and it blew the smoke from they fired smoke shells out in front of the tanks to identify where the line was supposed to be. But the wind blew the smoke back so that a lot of our own planes bombed our troops, not where exactly where we were. They were just a mile or so away. But that was pretty frightening. Just kind of hope that it didn't happen to us, you know.
You know, you talked about how secure you felt in your tank and how much you felt sorry for the guys outside. And then your tank gets hit and two of your men are killed and another one's wounded and you have to pull them out of the tank and you're banged up yourself. Did that change how you felt about being in the tank after that? Did you feel a little more vulnerable?
No, I still felt very secure in the tank because there were so many guys out exposed all the time, and we at least had the protection of something around us, heavy armor plate. You know, the 30-ton tank is a pretty good protection.
So you guys kept moving from there through northern France and Belgium and Holland and on into Germany by the winter, and this, of course, is the infamous winter of the Battle of the Bulge. Do I have it right that you got wounded right before the Battle of the Bulge?
Actually, yeah, it was at the very beginning of it. I wasn't even in the tank. You probably learned from others about how things were, but the Germans had dug protective V-shaped trenches that were deep enough so that if the tank once stayed in there, you couldn't get out. But after driving the Germans out of their positions there, these became our shelters, the V-shaped trenches. That day we had stopped whatever it was we were doing and started digging foxholes, which was kind of a new experience for the tankers, because most of the time when we stopped anywhere overnight, usually we'd sleep under the tank and didn't have to dig the foxholes like the infantrymen had to do. But anyway, we went down into these V-shaped trenches that the Germans had dug, and we could dig a foxhole horizontally instead of vertically. We could go into the side of this V, and I dug my hole. I wasn't used to digging a hole anyway, but I dug a hole, and then I threw my jacket in there, my tank jacket, to see if I was deep enough in, and I crawled in there to see if it was deep enough, and a shell came through the top of the dirt, and a fragment of it hit me right in the chest, right in the middle of the chest, and kind of rearranged my bones here for a little bit. But anyway, I was mad more than I was hurt. I didn't realize how badly I was hurt, but I had dug this nice tunnel there, and then they destroyed it before I had a chance to get any benefit. Anyway, some of the men pulled me out of the pile of dirt and called for medics and so forth, and I'd never forget the way they wrapped me up. Usually, the bandaging that was done with small pieces of whatever it was they used. But since I got hit right in the chest, they wrapped tape around me without any padding underneath or anything like that. So it was right on my skin. And I didn't realize right then what it was going to be like when I pulled that tape off of there. They took skin and all. That was the worst part of it, was getting treated.
How severe were your wounds? What was the damage done by that shrapnel?
Messed up a bunch of bones here in my chest, and apparently little tiny pieces of the shell penetrated in other parts, because after that, even after I was discharged from the Army, I had to go back to hospital, and because the little pieces of shrapnel would work their way out to the surface and kind of scratch, you know, and they had to remove that.
You think there's still some in there, or did you get it all by now?
Well, I don't attract magnets at all, so I guess it might all be out. But anyway, it was happening that just at the time that the Germans were starting on the Bulge in Belgium, south of us, we had gone through Belgium and Holland and up into Germany. We just barely got into Germany when the Bulge started, and they called for what turned out to be the most experienced of the tank divisions, which was the 2nd Armored Division. And they pulled us back from there in Germany down into a big valley, down big hills. And of course, it was very snowy and very slippery going. And we lost several tanks because they hit ice and they slid off and just rolled down into the valley. But anyway, we got down to a little town called Liège. And on Christmas Day, we spent Christmas. I was once again infantry. I didn't have a tank of my own, but I was. They were taking me along until they could get us transported somewhere. We got down into this valley down, and it was kind of strange because we were traveling in the same direction the Germans were. They were down below us in the valley, and they were coming this way, and we were coming down. We could see the Germans down in the valley. But anyway, Christmas Day, I was with a large group of guys that were in this town, and we'd gone into this bar, and of course they had stocked up with extra booze for the Christmas celebration, so it wasn't a bad place to be at the time. And we were under the tables, heavy tables, and the German planes, what few planes there were, was still strafing the streets outside. But as long as we stayed in the bar there, we were okay. It sounded like rain on the outside when the bullets were coming through. But I don't know that part is very interesting anyway.
Well, one thing that's interesting to me is how nonchalantly you're describing all this. If our listeners aren't paying close attention, they might forget you were first blown out of your tank in St. Lo in June of 44, losing 2 members of your crew, wounded yourself. You helped rescue another. Then in December, you're digging a foxhole in the side of this trench, and a German artillery shell literally shatters your chest. And then less than 10 days later, all bandaged up, you're hiding under a table in Belgium, hoping the German planes don't kill you. Yeah, none of that sounds like a big deal, right? We'll dig into it more with 89-year-old Charles Jennings of Morro Bay when Hometown Heroes continues right
after. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need 1,000 words, just 2 of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, 2 more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you 2 more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. When we left off with World War II tank commander Charles Jennings, he was all bandaged up from the wounds he suffered at the outset of the Battle of the Bulge, and he was hiding under a table on Christmas Day while German planes bombed and strafed outside. And even once you finally made it to a hospital, that wasn't even a remotely safe place to be.
I was taken back to a place where there was a big civilian hospital, was put into the hospital there. It was several stories high, kind of a U-shaped building, and the Germans then were dropping bombs and firing what we found out were V-1 rockets, and one or more of them landed in the middle of this hospital, the U-shaped hospital, and blew out the windows. We started getting little blood spots on us because the little pieces of glass were blowing all around us and getting into our skin. And so we thought, well, we're not through with this yet, apparently. So I got patched up there and went to another hospital, and they were bombing then with those V-2 rockets, which were more deadly. They had a motor on them, and they fly overhead, and all of a sudden the motor would stop, and you knew then that the bomb was coming down. Anyway, I got into Paris. Of course I wanted to go to Paris, but get in there with a couple of other guys, all bandaged up and half cast on, and we got to go into Paris and go in the Champs-Élysées and Eiffel Tower and all those places, but didn't want to stay because, and this is a kind of a disgusting part, but there were French men on every street corner beckoning to come with them, and they were taking guys somewhere where there were prostitutes. And with a half cast on, and my buddy who had an arm out like that with a cast, holding his arm out, and we still had our guns. They let us keep our pistols. We didn't want any part of all that was going on. Stayed in Paris only a couple of days and decided this isn't anything like we dreamed Paris was going to be. So we caught the trucks and planes out to the Bourget field and got back to England. And then it was just a matter of waiting in the hospital for transportation back home.
Well, you described being hit in the chest and that it just rearranged some bones and you had shrapnel to pick out and all that. But obviously these injuries were serious enough that the Army gave you a discharge form. I don't want to shortchange the extent of what you went through. Did it limit what you were able to do physically? Was there a lot of pain involved? What was it like for you?
Yes, but it didn't limit much because it was right here in the middle of my chest, and I was able to move everything, you know, and it didn't seem like anything other than bandage and stuff in my chest. And they discharged me before the war was over.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I certainly wasn't going to raise any fuss about getting sent out because I'd had enough, but the war was still going on, and I felt a little guilty about that, but 2 years later, after the medics said that I was all free of this shrapnel and stuff, I went to enlist in the Army, and they accepted me. I, at the time, was working. I quit my job, and I had married somewhere in this history. I had got married.
In fact, you had a daughter born while you were over there, right?
Yes, and when they took me, they said it was okay, I'd go in as a private. Well, which was fine. I just wanted to get back in.
Why'd you want to get back in so bad?
I liked the Army. I wasn't crazy about all that stuff that was flying around, but I liked being in the Army. I liked the discipline and the regimentation of the thing. But got to the railroad station to be taken back to Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and this major came along calling my name. He used a few well-chosen words telling me what he thought of me, because he said, "You're not even eligible to get back in. You've been in already, and yet you've had enough." So they took me back, and I had to go back and very sheepishly admit they wouldn't take me, you know. And that was the extent of my brilliant military career. There are things that I had experienced that I thought were wonderful. And if you got a few minutes, just one particular part of it. In Holland, we went into a little town. Holland has hills and mountains and things, you know. It's not like people think it is, all ice skaters everywhere, but they had a coal mine, and those of us who were officers there were invited to come and take showers in their big coal mine building. Of course, we took advantage of that. There was a man there that was called a traitor because he had worked so closely with the Germans all the time they were there. Turned out that he was all the time he training these young men. He had permission from the Germans to form like Boy Scouts, and they were hiking all over the area in Holland, and they were making maps. Every time they'd find a pillbox or anything that the Germans had there, why, they had it all mapped out of where they were. When we got there, this man was able to just turn all this information over to our army, and it helped a lot. I mean, they were able to wipe out a lot of emplacements there, but that's one part of the whole experience that I remembered so well, was this man who was a graduate of the University of Texas and just had worked so closely, though, with the Germans, because he was operating the coal mine and making sure they're doing the right thing for the Germans, but he was actually making all these maps and things, and it helped us tremendously.
Seems like that took a lot of guts to do something like that on his part, huh?
It had to. I mean, how can you even imagine what it was like to be surrounded with all these enemy, and yet they thought that you were part of what they wanted. I don't know how the man was able to do this. Never heard his name, but I think he was one of the greatest heroes of the war.
Certainly risked his life, no doubt. And I'm sure over the years, as you've reflected, you realize that you risked your life quite a bit in this war. And there are a couple times where it came close to being the end of your life over there. When you look back on everything you went through and the danger that you were in, the fate that you saw befall so many of your fellow Americans over there, what are you most thankful for? What are you most proud of all these years later?
Most proud of? I don't really know. Never thought much about being proud of anything, except that I was able to tell people about it. And there are so many thousands of guys that never got to tell anybody anything. I was one of the lucky people who got through it and never really felt that I had done all that I could have done, you know, if I stayed a while, you know.
Did you feel then, or do you feel now, when you think about how close you came to not coming home, do you feel like someone was looking out for you, or someone intervened on your behalf? How do you make sense of that?
Believe it or not, at the time I was in the Army all the time, I didn't believe in anything. Anything religious, certainly. There were guys around me that were praying, or they were doing things with beads or whatever. And I thought, you know, what good's that going to do, you know, if a shell's coming your way? You're not going to stop it by what you're doing. And it wasn't until long after that, well, long, a few years after that, when I got out, I was convinced that there was some power or something that was greater than anything that I had. And maybe this is a strange part of a combat tale, but when I was home and I was living in the home with a widow and her children, she happened to be a member of the Church of Christ, which I had never heard of. And she didn't have a car and she had no way to get to church, so they met for Bible study at her house, and I sat in on the studies. And at first I thought, well, that's ridiculous, that could never be. But then I started getting questions in my mind. Well, this is beginning to sound different. And if I had questions, I thought would throw them, they didn't argue with me at all. They just opened their Bibles and said, read this. I had no argument for that. It was already there, you know. And so I became fully convinced that that was the right way to go. I became a member of the Church of Christ. A young preacher from Texas was doing evangelistic work, and he baptized me and became a good friend over the years, and many, many, many years. I actually decided to become a preacher myself, and I went to college. I was able to go under the GI Bill, of course. After a little over 3 years, I graduated, and I was then a preacher myself. And I was a preacher for about 20 years, started working with some small groups and actually organized a couple of small churches and so forth. But after that many years, I had also become a hospital administrator in the latter part of that, because preachers didn't get quite enough money. So I had got a job in a hospital, and the administrator, after a number of months, says, well, I'm going to go on vacation. You take over. That was the beginning of my ability to be called an administrator and move on to other things. But after 20 years, I had to choose, really, because I got a lot of satisfaction in being able to see people coming to the hospital and receiving treatment and walking out healthy. I thought, well, that's really what I want to be a part of. So I didn't do any more full-time preaching. I just became an administrator and was able to go to 4 different hospitals over a period of 25 years. In the 3rd hospital, I took over as administrator. I met this lady. Her husband was a major in the Army, but he was a medical director of the hospital. So for 10 years, we worked together. And after I was no longer administrator, she and her husband came back into my life. He was very ill and eventually died, but we were friends and became more than that, and finally decided that I needed taken care of, so she took care of me for 21 years. I can't think of a better ending for any kind of a story. And believe me, it's not just a story. This is all true.
Well, I believe you, and I'm pretty sure our listeners do too. If you want to see a photo of Mr. Jennings and his wife Elaine, just get on Facebook and type in Hometown Heroes Radio. You'll find some photos of him as a 20-year-old tank commander, too. He really didn't want to draw too much attention to it, but boy, did he have some close calls. And those injuries he suffered were pretty severe, too. The Jennings live in Morro Bay. Next week will be just a short drive up the coast from there in Cayucas, where they're working hard to fix the iconic pier and where a 91-year-old can get pretty emotional about his time as a prisoner of war. That's what's coming up next time on Hometown Heroes. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.